old-fashioned school teacher. With 60 students, Miss Dice had little time to talk things over with individuals. She had to spend most of her time in class hearing recitation. But Miss Dice did her best, and she did it with system. After one class had recited at her desk, she tapped her bell to excuse them. Then she tapped the bell twice to call the next class to her desk. Both classes moved at one time, down one aisle and up another. Miss Dice would give two spelling tests at a time. Friend, she would dictate to one grade in a high voice, then in a lower voice to another grade, frown. Dictating words for one grade, then another, she went down both spelling lists at once. Miss Dice not only had system, but order. Sometimes while working out a problem on the board, she would hear a disturbance behind her. Then she would flick a bit of chalk over her shoulder toward the noise and say, writing again, "Bring that up here." Sometimes after a silence, someone would venture, "Who?" "You know who." If Miss Dice ever worried about losing control of the situation, no one guessed. She was neither cozy nor cross with her students, but she was in command. As happens with the best teachers, not everything she did was popular with her students. She put in all her scheduled classes every day. If recess time came when she still needed a bit of time to finish class, class came first. School ended at 4 o'clock usually, but on full days, Miss Dice sometimes dismissed 10 minutes later with no apologies. One time, one of the boys who was perhaps 16 years old told his friend, "She's not going to keep me past 4 o'clock today." He set his lunch pail on the bench near the door to be handy when he slipped out. Promptly at 4, while the other boys watched him and the teacher, he closed his book, moved to the back of the room, grabbed his lunch pail, and hurried out the door. Miss Dice saw him, hurried down the aisle, and out the door after him. A few minutes later, she reappeared at the door, holding her unwilling scholar by the arm. He had gotten as far as the church, about 100 feet away, before she had caught up to him. She found the classroom as orderly as when she left it. Boys from the neighboring Garfield School chuckled over the good behavior of Carrie Dice's students. "At our school, we do what we feel like," they said. "If we feel like going out the window during books, we go out the window. Your teacher wouldn't order us around as she does you." Shortly afterward, the school board asked Miss Dice to transfer to the very school whose boys had made these boasts. Whatever she might have thought of her own new task, she accepted it. Surprisingly, the school snapped to order. Miss Dice taught there as successfully as she had at her old school. Years later, some of Carrie Dice's former schoolboys visited her. "Miss Dice," they confessed, "when you were our teacher, we were afraid of you." Then Miss Dice said, "And I was afraid of you boys, too." Now, I read that not to tell you to try to be a Miss Dice. She was Miss Dice. You're not Miss Dice. You are you. And as we heard this morning, each of us has a somewhat of a different style, but one thing you could be sure, she was teaching out of who she was. She was who she was. She did have an order. There are things as a teacher that you can do, you can plan to do to establish and maintain order, but much of it has to do with being who you are. The handout I gave you says at the top, it has a couple quotes from a book I'll read a bit from here. It's an old book by Emerson White, printed in 1884. But he says, "A teacher can never put in a method what he does not have in himself." And he talks about the teacher as a governor, and that the teacher must, in fact, govern. A few years ago, the writer visited successively two schools that presented a most striking contrast in government. They were in the same building on opposite sides of a hall, and were composed of children of the same age, from largely the same families, thus presenting about equal difficulty in control. In one of these schools, we found a teacher evidently in a struggle from morning to night to control the pupils. He was earnest and determined, and his pupils seemed equally so. They walked heavily on the floor. They lounged in their chairs. They handled their books noisily, and otherwise kept up a din of poorly concealed disorder. There was insubordination in their look, in their voice, and in their bearing. On the opposite side of the hall, there was a teacher apparently unconscious of the fact that the control of 50 pupils rested on her. They had big classrooms in those days. When he entered, the visitor entered, the teacher was conducting a class exercise at the right, and while the visitor remained, not a glance of the eye showed a lack of confidence in her pupils. A beautiful spirit of love and harmony possessed the school. The pupils glided noiselessly from seat to class. The books were handled carefully, and a quiet order born of affection and goodwill pervaded the room. Here were blooming all those graces of spirit and conduct that adorn and make a beautiful child. Why the difference? Why on one side of the hall such obvious failure, and on the other side such admirable success? Some may think the differences were due to a difference in methods, to the fact that one had a better system of discipline than another. You might say, give me a copy of your discipline plan so I can use it. But as far as mechanism is concerned, they were using substantially the same method. They had the same plan of marking, the same system of reporting to parents, the same rewards for success in study, etc. There was doubtless some difference in the details and even in the plans, but the real secret was deeper than any system or any method. It was in the teacher. One failed because he had not in himself the elements of control, and the other succeeded because she possessed them. If there's going to be order in the classroom, it's going to be because of you. You will bring the order. It will not be the books you pass out. Now, obviously, the material the children have to work on, if you passed out frustrating material and then you tried to have order, you would have problems with them, because they'd be frustrated with material. But the material itself, no matter how well written, you can have an airy room, proper light, good ventilation, attractive walls, and good books, but it's the teacher who is going to bring the order to the room. And this order, it's an art. There are things that you can do. There's the knowledge that you can bring with you that is a help. Here's another brief account I'll give of an incident where a young man substituted temporarily in a school for a short period of time, maybe a month, that somebody was sick. And it says that in his first day, he spent most of his day learning his duties. After the opening exercises, the classes were called. And to his surprise, there appeared before him a class in physiology, a branch of which he was entirely ignorant. I guess all he could do was read the labels like we heard yesterday. His description of that first class, the teacher firmly seated in his chair, with his eyes on the text and his finger on the answers to the successive questions, has amused many an audience of teachers, too many of whom had probably realized in their own experience at least the suggestion of the situation described. When the young principal safely reached the close of that half-hour agony, he resolved that he would teach the class for the 8 weeks of this time, his substitute time, without again opening a book in the presence of the students, and he kept his resolution. He not only mastered the lessons he presented in the book used by the pupils, but he read other books on the subject. He interviewed physicians and even began the study of comparative physiology. As a result, he stood before his class daily full of physiology, and out of that fullness he taught the subject with glowing interest and enthusiasm. He made like preparations in the other branches, though less, being familiar with them, but he, quote, conquered the school with physiology, as he was wont to express it. He governed the great school for 2 months without one case of corporal punishment, which was unusual in those days. And at the close of his engagement, he was invited back to teach. Now, there's both fullness and freshness need. I'm alluding to a couple things here. And you read that instance and you say, well, there's no way that I could possibly spend that much time studying, say, physiology and learning all that. That's true. But there is something. In this case, he selected one thing that he could do well. And through that, it spilled over into other parts of the school day, the schoolwork, and affected how the students felt about school. There's at least something that happened well. Let's look at the outline, a few items here. The first, some principles. If they're going to manage a classroom, the first thing is order. There needs to be an order. And order is not, we're not talking about a stiff, regimented order here, but there has to be order. The class comes to order. Order is a way of doing things. You might call it procedure. A few basic things. God does value order, and there's order in the world around us, as opposed to chaos. There's a tendency, the second law of thermodynamics says that all things tend to go into a more disorderly condition. If you pick up a pile of things and drop them, there'll be more disorder than there was before. And there is a tendency among children, among people, there's a tendency for disorder. And in a case like this, where we have many people together here for these few days, we have to put some effort into coming up with an order just to get food. If we simply dismissed a group at lunchtime and said, the food's over in the cafeteria, go find it, you would find it, I'm sure. But people would wander this way, wander that way, come in from various doors and go down the lunch line in various ways, and it would take maybe three times as long to get lunch. Now, you're all very polite and mature, and so you wouldn't fight or squabble or throw food, but it would take twice as long, at least, to get lunch, and there would be some frustration. Somebody would have a sense, I wish somebody would come up with some kind of system here so we wouldn't have to waste so much time crossing paths. Order feels good. But it does have to be, it takes some thought to create this order. And it really starts with you. It starts with you as a person, as an individual. And the teacher himself, you yourself, must have a self-discipline, integrity. Integrity is a way of, quote, maybe you could say, having it all together. Having it, not that you are perfect, but having integrated, having ideas, how you proceed, how you do things, healthy relationships. It's out of your own self-discipline, whether it's your quiet time, time spent with other people. It's out of that healthy relationships with the church, healthy relationships with the books that you're going to be working with, and respect and so forth, that it's out of this that you can teach. We can't bring to bear in the situation in which we teach that which we have not mastered in our own lives. Mastering ourselves, coming up with an order ourselves. And the teacher is under authority. One of the fascinating stories in Scripture is where Jesus met the centurion, and the centurion said, I have a servant who is sick, and I'd like you to heal that person. He had apparently heard about or seen some miracles Jesus did, and he understood that Jesus could heal his servant. And Jesus, I don't know if Jesus knew what the centurion was going to say next or not, but he said, I'll come and heal him. He recognized that this man had faith. And the centurion responded by saying, well, actually, you wouldn't have to go and heal him. He said, you can heal him from here, from where you are. He said, I'm a man myself under authority, and I understand how this works. I can tell this person to go here, and he'll go and do it. And it happens over there a mile away. I don't have to be there and see that it happens. And he understood that you would be able to do the same thing yourself. You don't have to go there in person. And Jesus said, wow. I haven't seen this kind of understanding in all Israel. This man really understands something. Now, we ourselves must be under authority. If we expect students to accept our authority, a first step is for ourselves to be under authority. So one of the things to sit down and ask yourself is, how do I respond to the authorities in my life? How do I respond to those people who, how do I respond to God? How do I take orders and direction from God? Do I respect, fear, and love God? Do I take his directions as kind directions in my life? If I see God's directions as regimentation, as commands, jump and ask how high I'm supposed to jump after you're on the way up, well, that's probably the way I'm going to come across to my students. So a first step is to have a proper attitude about submission, also recognizing that we're under the authority of the parents who hired us. They hired us to do a job. We're not coming in there just with our own agenda to do our own thing. And the church that you're a part of, are you respectful? Are you under proper authority there? And then what I mean by the unchangeables, one who accepts the unchangeables, are you okay with who you are, with how tall you are, with the personality, as we heard this morning, that God gave you? And if we expect our children, if we expect to work with children and help them when they're frustrated, help them through their feelings of nobody likes me or pays attention to me, or other people are so slow, or other people are so dumb, different kinds of comments children will make. If we expect to help them, we ourselves must work through and accept those unchangeables, the family that God placed you in, the state that you're living in. Paul said, I've learned whichever state I am there with to be content. So I think he'd be happy to teach in Missouri, or happy to be in Pennsylvania or Ohio, or to be in whatever condition. So the unchangeables of life, we must accept them. And it's out of that, a person who blesses God for placing where you have, giving me the face you've given me. If you've given me hair, I bless you for that. If the Lord takes the hair, you bless him for that. And you're okay with just where you are and who you are and the time of life you are. And out of that, then you're in a position to work with other people and help them also be under authority. Well, as I mentioned the other day, the pressing things sometimes take place over the important things. So we get to part two in the outline, suggestions for establishing and maintaining control. These suggestions, these are not laws. They aren't things that have a direct cause-effect relationship. But they really will only work if number one is in place, if Roman numeral one is in place. So the important things here, pondering how we ourselves are with God and with others, is the foundation. And so then looking for establishing, maintaining control. A major thing is procedures. Some of you might have seen the book called The First Days of School. It's for sale over here in CLR. It's written by an Asian, Chinese, Japanese, I'm not sure which, Wong, I think his name is. And his thesis is, figure out the procedures. Children, much of the difficulty that arises in the classroom arises from not thinking through smooth procedures. Either students don't know what they're supposed to do, actually don't know what they're supposed to do, or we don't see that they do it. And so know what you are doing, what you want to accomplish, and how to do it. Now, this applies to teaching. I was talking yesterday about teaching classes. Surely you want to know your subject. But this is more the general overall classroom feel. Know what you're doing, how you're going to do it, and how to do it. What you will do and why, and what the children will do and why. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have a reason for every move they make and be able to articulate that. But there's a reason. There's a reason, for example, why you want them to line up, maybe, before they go out the door. It just achieves order. They're more likely to not crowd through the door, and there'll be less disorder. One general thing that I'd like to mention related to this is that it's, if you pick, let me back up and say this first. If you allow one kind of disruptive behavior, let's suppose, for example, you allow students to talk without, just whenever they have something to say, they can just talk out without raising their hand, maybe talk while you're talking. If you allow that, that kind of disruption or looseness will affect other parts of the school day, other parts of the school program, other parts of the feel of, or the morale or the school spirit, far beyond just talking in class. And so it's important to pick a few things and do them well. And those things that students are expected to do well carry an impact far beyond that thing. For example, a first grade teacher in our room for years has taught her children to always push in their chairs when they leave the desk. They get up, and if they're going to chalkboard, if they're going to come to read, whatever, they get up, they push their chair in, and then they go and do what they're going to do. Now, what's the big deal about pushing chairs in? When they come back again to sit down, they're going to have to pull out. And nobody's supposed to walk through there anyway. And so why not leave the chair out? Give me a reason. What good might that do? What would you say? All right. It's an orderly activity. And it's really not about having the chair in under the desk. But it's one thing, it's a reasonable thing to do. It's not unreasonable. Now, if she asked him to turn the chair around three times and then push it in, that would be an arbitrary, you know, unreasonable thing. But it's not an unreasonable thing to do. But that very act, that discipline, and if they forget to do it, they can be sent back, you forgot to push your chair in. They have to think a little bit. It actually develops a habit eventually. It's a kind of considerateness, but it is an example of an orderly pattern of behavior. And you don't need too many of those things, but that carries over. It helps to achieve a habit of doing things in an orderly way. Now, you wouldn't want to have a dozen of those things where they would forget them, but you pick a few and insist on them and do them well. And it tends to create an atmosphere of order. With older children, it might be something different, but choose a few things. Children tend to live up to your expectations. Expect them to obey. If you're going to step out of the room, don't say, I need to step out of the room now, and when I come back, I expect you to be sitting quietly, working, I don't want to see any talking. Understand, and then walk out of the room. What have you just told them? You just told them that I really have a little difficulty trusting you, and I'm afraid if I do step out, you're likely to fool around. I don't want you to fool around. I'm kind of, if you didn't think about fooling around before, you might now, because I just planted the idea in your head. It would be much better to simply open the door and walk out and do what you need to do. And then when you come back, if they're doing well, don't say, wow, you're really quiet. I'm glad to see that you're quiet. Again, you might be telling them, I really didn't think that you would be quiet. I'm kind of surprised that you behaved so well because I thought you would probably misbehave. But just somehow, in an unspoken way, expect. Now, I'm not saying to never commend them, but... And if someone is then doing something that he or she shouldn't do, why, you can make some comment. If I need to step out for something, I expect you to keep working and not sit there and talk. And let them know what your expectations are. But don't harp on it. Love your children. It goes without saying that we need to love our children. That's a command. But it's also important to learn to like them. Liking is more of an emotion, a feeling. And you can have an interesting discussion. You can talk this one over afterwards. Must you like your children? Is it wrong to not like them? And is it possible to like everybody? Well, liking has teachers need to develop, need to cultivate a liking for the children. Some people are more likable than others. We tend to like to be around people who are similar to us. Teachers tend to like children who ask questions, but not too many questions. They don't like maybe the Thomas Edisons in their class. They don't like people who derail their plans. They don't like people who throw paper airplanes or whatever. But children know whether you really want to be in that classroom or not. They know whether you are enjoying the day. They know whether you're happy to be around them or not, or whether they may wonder, do you like me? Care about your children. Affection can be nursed or neglected. You can cultivate being affectionate. That doesn't mean that you have to hug or be patting or being gushy about it. Different personalities have different ways of showing affection, but affection shows that it's a feeling that you care about the person. You care about whether this person understands or is interested or is awake or whatever. And win their hearts. The other day I said, don't steal their hearts, but you do want to win their hearts. And there's a difference. If you steal a heart, while you kind of have that person might more or less worship you or have you as the idol, or you might that person might accept your word above anybody else's. But if the children don't put their hearts into the work, if they don't trust you, if you give them cause to mistrust you, if you disrespect them, or maybe you just accept them conditionally, you're not very likely to have them put their hearts into the work. And there's a healthy way. If children are ready to, for example, if you were going to go on a walk, if a child's ready to go along on a walk with you, why, they've given you a certain level of trust. And in the classroom, in a sense, we're going on a walk together. So think about these things. Do I respect them, and do I love them? Do I care about them? Any comments or questions? Feel free to speak out without raising your hand, or ask any question here if you'd like me to. Be open to your students' individual weaknesses, strengths, interests, needs. As you plan lessons, as you make bulletin boards, as you plan things, think about your students. Maybe you have a student who really would like to design a bulletin board or help make a bulletin board, or somebody who might enjoy staying after school. Some student might really enjoy being invited to stay after school for an hour and help make a bulletin board sometimes, or check some papers. Somebody might be interested in reading a story they've written to the class. Somebody might have stones they collect, something they like to show the class. Making your classroom a museum, have a little table where you put some interesting things you've found, invite them to bring things in. Just being open, being aware, having your eyes open. I remember years ago there was a girl, I think a seventh or eighth grade girl, who had an unusual interest in collecting rocks, collecting minerals. And I remember having an opportunity to stop by. Maybe we were at their place for supper as a teacher, but I remember her showing me her stone collection. And it's kind of unusual. There aren't all that many seventh or eighth grade girls that have a rather extensive stone collection. But just showing that to her teacher. And you cultivate an awareness of your students' particular interests and strengths, weaknesses, that helps you be personable with them. And this isn't necessarily, this doesn't necessarily mean that you spend a lot of time, but it doesn't take much time necessarily to let a student know that you're interested in what they're interested in, or invite them to offer something based on their interest. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. Teachers need of their heads. You've heard the statement that you have eyes on the back of your head. And there is a sense that you need to cultivate, and it should come after a while, that you develop a feel. It's like a sixth sense. You feel whether all is well with what's going on. Maybe you're playing dodgeball, for example. And there are many ways to play dodgeball. And you have to have a sense of, is this game going well? Children can be throwing dodgeballs like bullets. They can be malicious. A dodgeball can be malicious. It can be friendly. It can be orderly. It can be fun. It can be raucous. It can be hilarious, mischievous. There are different spirits that a game can take on. And you have to have a sense of, is this good? Is this done well? Or are there students being picked on? Or are there students dominating? And sometimes you need to, and if it's not well, what are you going to do about it? Or you might need to say, we're not going to play dodgeball for a couple weeks, we'll play something else. Or maybe, and it's just going to depend on your relationship with the students and who you are, you might be able to just tell them, we're not, this doesn't feel good. And it isn't about the speed of the balls. If you just say they're throwing the balls too fast, you can slow the balls down and still have this same, does this make any sense? The important thing is students, they should know that you see and that you notice, but the eyes that are watching them should be friendly eyes. It makes a big difference whether they think you are staring at them or whether you're watching them like a detective or a police officer, or whether you're watching them as a teacher, as one who is with them. We're in this together. We're learning together. And I am for you. I'm for you. I'm on your side. It makes a big difference whether children sense, you never want to have a feel of opposition develop, that it's you against me, but rather in a sense that I'm with you, we're together as a group and we're working on this task together. Now I'm leading, I'm in charge, and I'm aware if you people get to whispering or pestering each other, I'm going to be aware of that, and I'm going to see that you stop that. But I'm going to have the assumption as a teacher that really, in your heart of hearts, you want somebody who causes you to do that which you should do. You know, the teacher is the one who causes the student to do that which in his heart he really wants to do, but wouldn't do it unless someone causes him to do it. There's a wonderful illustration in a children's book called Farmer Palmer's Wagon Ride, in which the farmer is a pig, and the mule is pulling the wagon, and they're coming home one sultry summer day, and it's hot, and the mule stops, and he says, I'm tired. I don't feel like going on. And the pig farmer says to him, well, what do you suppose we ought to do about this? We do need to get home. And the mule said, well, perhaps if you gave me a little switch with the whip, that would help. And the pig said, all right. So he took the whip and he switched it over the mule's back. The mule said, yeah, that helps. And then he started walking along again. Now, I love that illustration because children know. They really do want to get their math finished. There's a wonderful feeling in having the homework finished. There's a wonderful feeling when things are in order. You don't really want him to make problems for you. Not really, because if he does, it's going to be a disruption. we're not going to learn as much. And so you really want the teacher to keep order. In their inside, in the heart of hearts, students appreciate order. Now, if you ask them, they might say it's fun to be able to whatever, throw things, walk around, dawdle, slouch, whatever. And our eyes that see, then they need to be friendly eyes, not gushy, not buddy-buddy eyes, but it means eyes that I see you and I'm with you. And you don't really want to be doing that, do you? And persons that, you know, might know, no, I don't really want to, all right, and we're not going to do it. Let's get to work. And so you do, and it's amazing. Teachers have different ways of controlling. I had a teacher in grade 9. She was a French teacher. That is, she taught French. And I'm not sure, I never did find out, but it may very well have been her first year of teaching. She was a young teacher. And in that whole year, I only remember her stopping her teaching about 2 or 3 times to actually rebuke a student to do some kind of a classroom management statement. And basically the way she controlled the class, and there were about 30 students in there, the way she controlled the class was with her eyes. That was 2 things. She knew what she was doing, and she just, from the time the class started, we went someplace and we were all involved. And she controlled with her eyes, and if you thought about doing something that was not proper classroom behavior, many students look at the teacher as or before or related to it. For example, if you had a pen and you were just fiddling with the pen a little bit, if you looked up at her, she didn't skip a beat, but you found her looking at you. And you had a tendency to stop doing what you were doing and pay attention. And she didn't say a word, she just kept right on. The fascinating thing about managing a classroom is that there's no direct correlation at all between the size of the teacher, the height of the teacher, the size of the teacher, the muscles of the teacher, and the ability to manage a classroom. You can have a pert, small, young lady, and you can have a big, hulking man, and she can have a room that is perfect order, responds well. You can have big lumbering boys responding very well to this short lady, and you can have young children cutting up and being hilarious in the class with a big hulking man. It has little if anything to do with the size of the person. Now on the first day or two it might help if you're 6'4" and weigh 300 pounds to walk in there. The children might be for a couple days until they find out. But there's something about the bearing, about the way the person carries himself. F here, give some time thinking about, now you might think in this list I put on the outline that you're supposed to think about every move children make. Not exactly. Some of these things you won't think about until school gets underway and you get into it a week or so. But nevertheless, think about the moves they make. When they get off, they will very soon, if you don't give any direction as to what they're to do when they get to school, they will develop a pattern. When they get off, come out of the cars or the bus, however they arrive, do they enter the building? Do they stand outside and talk until the bell rings? Do they lay down their book bags or backpacks outside and gather in the restroom and chat in the restroom? Do they come into the classroom? Do they sit down at their desks? Do they play a game? What are they supposed to do before school? Now, if it's only a couple minutes, that's not as important. If you have people getting there 15, 20 minutes before school starts, you need to give some thought to that, because over the year's time, they will develop a pattern, and you have to think about what you want them to do during that time, and then how they move between classes. Sometimes in our school, we have a, a large, we have a classroom in each end of a large room about the size of this room. And there's a classroom here, two classrooms here, and a classroom over there. And sometimes they go from one room to the other between classes. Well, this room, it happens to be the playroom where you play games and dodgeball and all kinds of running games. So between classes, this open room is a hall. You know, it's a way to get from one room to the other. At recess time, it's the place where you play. And so it's very easy for children when they enter this room to have the feeling this is the playroom and this is a place to run. And you have to decide whether you're going to allow running from when they go from one class to the other, or whether you say when you go from one class to the other, you walk, and then other times when you're in that room and play a game that you run. There's things like that come up. Do they line up? How do you dismiss? And teachers will do differently. You probably don't want a school-wide policy for this. It has more to do with the grade level and the teacher's personality. Some teachers will have students stand up beside their desks and file out by rows. Some will have them line up at the door to go out. Some will simply say, you're dismissed, and it works well. And children simply will walk out. Other teachers don't say anything, wait till the bell rings, and the room just explodes with people falling over each other to get out. Does the bell dismiss the students, or do you dismiss the students? If you don't decide that, they will decide for you. And when that bell goes, if you're in the middle of a sentence, do they close the books and walk out if it's time to go? Or is that bell a reminder for the teacher, and then you tell the students, now the class is over? You will soon find out things will happen, and they'll do things, and then you don't think about all these things on ahead, but as something comes up, then you need to decide whether you need to make a policy for it or not. Things like passing in papers. All right, you take a test, and they're sitting back at their desks, and so you get finished, and you get up and bring your test up and lay it at my desk, and go back and sit down. You get up and bring yours up and lay it down. Or each day, when you're finished checking your math papers, does each person walk up individually, or do they pass them up? Just thinking about things like that, and things you don't think about on ahead, a couple days into the year, you'll say, oh, there's a bit of confusion here. I need to develop a simple procedure for this. And my comment here, work for body life functioning, not mere mechanical movement. What I mean by that is you don't want a regimented, stiff movement where the children are frayed, scared, where they do things mechanically. This is the way we need to walk. But orderly. There's a way of being dynamic, of being orderly, respectful. And if you want a few words, some words I've used quite a few times over the years is try to narrow it down to about five words that pretty much carry the atmosphere. And those words were words like punctuality, being punctual. See, punctuality, and so that has to do with getting in time, has to do with passing papers in, getting homework passed in time. It has to do with being ready for class, when it's time for math class, to put away your things and getting other books out. Punctuality, and then order, just being in order. And if a student is disorderly, it could show up in various ways. Maybe he's tipping back on his chair. Maybe he's doing something carelessly. And you don't have a whole list of orders of rules and say you've broken rule number 16. But just that's disorderly. Work is another one. Just we're here to work, and we don't sit around wasting time. We work. Neatness is carries a variety of things. Writing neatly, being neatness, and respect. That's a broad one. You ask students to be respectful of other people, which includes the teacher, includes other children, It includes some funny-looking person that goes past on the road, or a salesman that maybe stops in, or talking about parents, respect for property, the way they take care of the school books, respect for themselves, respect for God. That's a word you can get a lot of mileage out of and call students to be respectful. And then help children establish and practice procedures and routines. You might have routines planned out, but you need to see that it happens. The power of habit is a wonderful power. They say if you do something for 30 times, 30 days, you've established a habit. You try it in getting up in the morning. Get up at a precise time, 30 mornings in a row, and then see whether you need an alarm clock anymore. Does anybody ever get awake on the minute? Do you ever get awake just about when your alarm, maybe just before the alarm goes, and then you reach out and turn it off, and then you get up, right? It's amazing, the power of habit. And you can have that work for you. Sometimes you think of bad habits, they're being bad things, but there are good habits. And so you might have a procedure mapped out. This is the way we file out to lunch. This is where we put our lunch boxes and so on. But yes, have that work for you. And some of these things are things like habits, even of kinds of things they talk about. You might have to monitor, for example, the lunchtime conversation. There are certain conversations, certain things that they don't need to talk about. If the boys get carried away with too much ridiculous talk about tractors and get arguing about it and starts hurting feelings, you can say, look, we're just not going to talk about tractors at lunchtime or whatever it is. You can, as a teacher, it's your responsibility to see that bad patterns of behavior don't develop. And it isn't that this subject necessarily is good or bad to talk about, but it's the way it's being done. And they will appreciate if you step in and say, we're not going to do that. A few comments about the list here. In your teaching, much of the managing of the classroom does have to do with how you go about teaching. You do want some variety in the context of routine. Routine is the meat and potatoes. Routine is the main dish. Routine is the main course of school. And variety is the dessert. Variety is the spice of life. Variety is the spice of teaching. There are few people, if any, who would appreciate a meal of spice. I don't know if you ever tried just eating up spices with nothing else with them or not, but spice adds something to it. And don't feel that you always need to be coming up with something different. It's good to have some different things, but routines, interesting routines, well thought out routines, order. And then predictability without boredom. What I mean there is that this fits with the routine. Students should know what to expect. They should know pretty well how classes are going to function. And then, of course, if some are different, that's fine. But it shouldn't be so rote, so predictable, that they actually could role play for you. In other words, if you wouldn't be there someday, if your routine is that much the same, that some student could come up and impersonate you and say, now, boys and girls, it's time for math class. Get out your books and turn to the lesson for today, which, by the way, is lesson 16. And John, would you read the example for us? Well, thank you, John. Now, we will see if we can do that on the board. So you may go up to the board and line up, and I will give you a problem to do. Now, if you would always be that mechanical each time that a person could actually go up and recite what you're going to do, there's something a little wrong there. And this is the kind of thing that they need. There's a predictability. I'm not saying that a student shouldn't be able to go up and impersonate you. It is, some people can impersonate people very well, but it would be more impersonating your spirit, the way you do things, and not, they shouldn't be able to predict exactly just how you're going to say everything every time. Boredom is really, boredom has a different definition today than it had 20, 30 years ago. Boredom used to mean that a person was maybe getting too much of one thing in one way for too long, and his mind kind of got tired. Boredom today, when people say I'm bored, it seems to suggest that they have to have constant input because they really have no, they have no critical mass inside. They have nothing to keep them going inside. And so unless I have something constantly coming into me from outside, I'm bored. Now, that's a different subject. That's, I think, we could talk about that. A teacher, for sure, needs to be one who is cares about a subject, has something to say, something to offer, and not be boring. And then challenge without frustration. If you're truly frustrated, that means you can't figure out something. If you're frustrated, if you are trying to open a box and you just can't get this box open no matter how hard you try, you're frustrated in your attempt to open the box. So a student who truly is frustrated cannot figure out how to do this kind of math problem. And somebody else might help him get an answer, but without that person's help, he still can't do it. And when you're frustrated too often, it really affects your attitude towards school. You need to be alert. Are these students being frustrated? And there's various kinds of frustration. Some children are frustrated because they don't know what to expect of you as a teacher. And some children are frustrated because other people are bothering them constantly and they can't pay attention. So you need to be alert to people who are feeling frustrated. On the other hand, they need to be challenged. That's what school is about. As I've said already, when children come to school in the morning, if they don't have problems before they get to school, we're sure going to give them problems. That's what school consists of, problem after problem after problem. And here's a problem to solve, here's another to solve. Without problems, there's no learning. But it needs to be a problem that is a challenge, but not frustrating. So we need to be aware of that. Cheerfulness without frivolity. Don't try to be funny. There is plenty of good humor in life. There are interesting things to see and to notice, to observe. Have you ever seen a little child laugh for the sheer joy of being alive, or for the sheer joy of seeing an insect crawl up a stem? That's an innocent kind of exuberance about life. And there are things that come up along the way, either statements people make, observations people make, questions they bring up. There are things that arise that are funny and sometimes hilarious, that you don't need to try to create humor. And children will soon detect if you're injecting stories and jokes, just, you know, it's time for a laugh here, almost like it's in your lesson plans, third of the way through, tell a funny story. They will not appreciate that. They might laugh, but if it's overdone, if it's too much, if it's not related in any way to anything they're doing, they really will get tired of it. And then purpose without drudgery. Drudgery is just working away, and maybe the teacher's half bored, or the teacher feels like this is drudgery, the students feel like it's drudgery. But if there's a sense of purpose, it can be really hard work, and children will not, it isn't hard work that makes children be out of order or want to do something different. It's often just that drudgery, lack of freshness. Let's go to the back side. Keep the workload reasonable. You might be surprised, but sometimes we have more trouble if they don't have enough to do. If you cut back on the assignment, on the work too much, if it gets too light, they'll complain about having too much work. You try it. No, don't try it. Just take my word for it. If the workload is too light, why, they can complain that, why should we have to do these problems? You cut back more, and children generally, they ought to be busy, not overloaded, but you have to feel your way there. And one of the ways of doing that is to talk with parents, especially at conference time. I like to ask parents, how much time does this child work on homework at home? If they say, well, generally after supper, they start around 7 and get done around 10, you say, oh, wait a minute, there's something not right here. They shouldn't be working 3 hours at home every night. Jay, be aware. This has to do with these eyes, or more like friendly ears perhaps, just an awareness. This has to do with supervision. Be aware of how teens are picked. One of the experiences that children will say, maybe some of you experienced this, this should not happen. Time after time, at lunchtime, that two boys pick up teams, you know, I'll take this person, I'll take that person, I'll take this one, that one. And then these poor players stand there until it gets down to the last couple, and finally there's only two or three people left. Well, okay, you have that one, and I have this one. And these worthless people have that feeling of always being at the bottom of the pile. If you're going to pick up a team, obviously you want matched teams, and that's where you're getting matched teams. But if you're going to have two people pick teams, have those two people get together and say, I want you two to make up softball teams and try to make them even. So you make up those lists, but there's no reason to have the people stand up there and go through the experience of being selected. And then when I say how games are picked, this is a little different. Who decides what games are picked? Does one child pick them always? And I'm not telling you how you should do it, but give attention to that. Maybe you choose them. Maybe you have the children all submit games they like to play, and then you have some kind of random choosing. But give some thought, because children have feelings. Children have feelings. And the feelings they have about these things in school are very big about the way they feel about school. If you like to play a certain kind of game, and the teacher does entertain suggestions for playing games at recess, and your game is never played, or students are allowed to make comments about this dumb game, and you picked it, that can affect your whole school day, far more than anything you do in math, history, or science. Watch for friendships. Watch for children who are little. Watch for things like cliques. That develop, or somebody being let out. Be alert to that. And if you see something that happened, it might, like someone said, if you see something happen that might, maybe an egg might hatch, watch it closely. But not every egg has a snake in it. Some eggs are just innocent things. And so not everything needs to be headed off, but some things you need to watch out for. Expressions, terms. Keep them occupied, keep them challenged. Yesterday we heard Marcus talk about giving people something to do, think about, and care about. Children do. The power of ideas is big. We heard about curiosity this morning. And if children just work and don't really have any ideas to occupy their minds, this is where stories have a place. Posing brain teasers on the wall, inviting children to offer brain teasers, putting a question before them occasionally, things to think about can keep up interest and keeps them engaged. And then something to do. And many times if there's misbehavior, it's because they simply don't have enough to do or enough purposeful things to do. The playtime is supposed to be the fun time of school, but it has maybe the most potential for problems. Manage it well. Don't tell them every move to make. They also had the experience of everybody playing together. We play some things together. They all also ought to have some freedom to just go out and play, swing, seesaw, whatever. So spontaneity and also working together. If you want to lose control, here are a few suggestions. Sometimes you can understand how to do by looking at the opposite. Being indecisive, that should say being indecisive or impulsive. Of course, both would do it too. But if you're indecisive, if you say, let's see, for tomorrow in math, let's do problems, let's do the odd numbers. No, I guess we'll make it the evens. Let's do the even numbers for tomorrow. And being indecisive or impulsive, just throwing something out and just off the cuff. For tomorrow, let's do a report about insects. You do one on bees, you do one on birds. Birds aren't insects, are they? Well, doing something impulsive, it gives a feeling that you don't really know what you're doing. You haven't thought through this. If I haven't thought through it, is it really worthwhile for you to do? And also, asking to do something that you really can't enforce.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.